It's great to have you back with us today for another big GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Dr. Chris Martinson. Joining me today with his outlook on the precious metal sector, co-founder of PeakProsperity.com, developer of the educational video series, The Crash Course, and author of The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and Environment. Welcome back, Chris Martinson.
Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. And apologies for our last discussion. Sadly, one of the first times in nearly a decade, we lost the entire nearly 60-minute discussion. So maybe we can recapture some of the witty repartee and interesting topicality today. Wanted to begin with the Ukraine. They're finally admitting now, after several months of speculation by ZeroHedge.com, they've been vindicated. The central bank has admitted the gold is gone. They sent it via airliner in the middle of the night with people in unmarked outfits, shipped it off to the United States. Of course, now 42 tons. Compare that with China and Russia combined. But quite an interesting development given what's occurring on the Eastern Front. Any comments here?
Well, it's mysterious. You know, it's not just Ukraine's gold that we would wonder about. We have to wonder where Libya's gold went. That seemed to have gone missing. And where did Iraq's gold all go? Nobody's got a single answer for that. And so one of the things that's pretty obvious is that when instability comes to a country and the United States is involved, the chances of your gold disappearing are about 100% at this point. So we're not, you know, we're just drawing conclusions here, and you know, correlation isn't necessarily implying causation, but this is a pattern we've seen over and over again. And what's fascinating is that just recently we're watching the Swiss National Bank go through all of its gyrations to pretend as if it would just be a huge inconvenience for them if they had to repatriate their gold and why it would be a terrible idea. And they are on record as saying that gold just really doesn't have a very useful role to play in monetary functions anymore. And that, so this official poo-pooing of gold stands on one side of the story. On the other side, as soon as trouble erupts, mysterious men, well-armed, well-organized, with access to planes, machine guns, and other hardware, somehow managed to spirit your gold away. It doesn't really jive with this story that it's an unimportant substance that nobody cares about anymore.
Right, that old barbarous relic. You'll recall all of that hoopla over Muammar Gaddafi and the missing gold. And so I think that's very timely. It reminds me of the Hegelian dialectic. Create a problem. Oh, wait a minute. You know, there's a possible invading force on the Eastern Front. Got to get the gold somewhere safe. Let's put it in the vaults in Fort Knox and New York vaults. Let's put it in the place where it'll be likely rehypothecated who knows how many times over and leased out. Wouldn't you send it to London before you would send it to the United States? We've read all these reports under the table. Much of that conflict may have been fomented by some of the special interests, particularly in the energy sector in the West. Something is not quite right here. Tell us more.
I am absolutely on the side that there's something here that doesn't add up. And anybody who's familiar with the gold story knows this, that good gold figures are harder to come by than the blueprints for nuclear weapons. Yeah, right? You can just for some reason, we managed to hide gold. And again, for a barbarous relic, it sure does command an awful lot of secrecy. And that secrecy extends to, you know, people look at the COMEX numbers, and frankly, those are chump change. You know, we get to see what the open interest is and what's registered, what's eligible, and people parse through the numbers and go, oh, no, look, you know, J.P. Morgan's down to its last 30,000 ounces or whatever. But that's chump change compared to the OTC market in London. That is the largest physical market, and that is completely opaque. We don't know what's going on in there. So we have to back up, and we have some data. India tells us how much they import. China tells us how much they import. And we have good numbers, and we know that together those two are importing more than all of the world output in mines. So there's a deficit there. And gold is this wonderful thing. You can't print it out of thin air. You can rehypothecate it all you want in your paper games, but when India and China import physical, it came from somewhere. The most conservative guess I have at this point is that a minimum of 1,000 tons had to come from the West just to satisfy those two countries and over the past year. So where did that come from? Well, somebody has to be coughing up this gold. Now, you mentioned the Bundesbank. Very interesting. The Bundesbank, after the fall of Berlin and the separation of it in World War II, they sent a bunch of gold out for safekeeping, some to France, some to New York. there was a call to get a portion of that back. They were only going to get 300 tons back from New York. And a year later, they had managed to repatriate only 5 tons out of that 300, saying, oh, transportation difficulties, which, by the way, whoever did it in Ukraine had no difficulties on that one, right? Transportation, they should call those guys. They could get it done by tonight, apparently. So then they gave these stories that just didn't make sense. Oh, the bars, we had to remelt them. There was sort of refinery capacity issues. I'm like, what are you talking about? Really? That's your story, huh? And so whatever the real story is, we know that Germany has been having a lot of difficulty getting their gold back. And there's been a lot of discussions around that. We're free to guess then. Is it, why is it hard to get that gold from point A to point B? And my best guess is that the title of ownership is no longer clear on that gold. It's got a bar number. It's been sitting in the vault for a long time. It may even still be in the vault of the New York Fed, but they may have leased it in a lease arrangement or a swap arrangement. So then certificate title passed to party A, call it J.P. Morgan, who then said, oh, I've got some certificate gold here, and then they sell it off to some hedge fund who then can use that as collateral, and they title it off, and somebody else buys it. But eventually there's somebody in that chain that thinks they own a gold piece of gold with a bar number on it, and the truth is they don't. And you have to unwind that whole chain before you can free that bar up and ship it back to Germany. I think that's what the trouble is here, but I'm not positive.
You're certainly on the path here. And look at this from another perspective. You know, I had Ron Paul, Dr. Paul, on the show just a few weeks ago. I think dawned on us nearly simultaneously. The bulb went off, seemed to almost come to the conclusion with synchronicity that isn't it interesting? After the Bundesbank had been a little upset, and there's been, you know, rumors of, you know, repatriation in Switzerland as well. There's a big referendum coming up here at the end of the month. I think it's November 30th. 1,500 tons, I mean, a huge amount of gold that they want back. And it's just interesting that suddenly Europe doesn't look quite so much like Fortress Europe anymore. The London Telegraph said a de facto Cold War, whether the mainline media wants to admit it or not. But and another thing I'd like to point to here that I think you brought up, and I think it's a great point. Of course, now China overtaking India as the world's largest purchaser of the yellow metal. Gold doesn't leave the country. If just China and India alone are consuming most of the world's gold output, is it the gold ETFs that are, you know, sending their gold to them? Is it the central banks? The takeaway point here is that gold is gone forever. They're not going to sell it, unlike our central banks, or lease it or give it away at any price. Once Russia, which has a voracious appetite for gold, China, India, they accumulate for generation. So it's a sea change event, but the markets don't seem to have taken notice of this. Any comments before we move on?
Well, this has been one of the more mysterious factors. You know, it was when QE Infinity, this most recent round that the Fed just actually ended, this latest round was announced, that really gold started to reverse and go backwards in earnest. And that was just kind of a too cute by half coincidence. And of course, only in the Wall Street Journal is it proposed that when the price of gold goes down, investors hate it and they lose interest in it. Because in China, when the price goes down, they get really interested in it and they buy more of it. It's kind of how supply and demand seems to work with price, you know. And so we've watched this extraordinary exodus of gold from west to east. 2013, I think the deficit could have been largely accounted for by the amount of gold that GLD, the ETF, coughed up, close to 800 tons. That could have made up for the shortfall, but in 2014, GLD has been roughly constant in terms of its tonnage. Somebody had to hemorrhage at least 1,000 tons, but I'm thinking it might be more. And to me, this is the context for understanding why gold gets whisked away in the dead of night, potentially, because somebody somewhere says, we have to keep supplying gold to keep this game going a little bit longer. And I'm sure that whoever whisked it away gave a nice piece of paper to the Ukrainians and said, don't worry, we got it. It's at 33 Liberty Street. It'll be there forever.
Yeah. Just who will own it is another question altogether.
Well, just don't ask for it back, because then you'll find all sorts of reasons and diplomatic pressure that says, not now. How about not now? Now's inconvenient.
Sure,
hard to ship.
Or just go ahead and ask for it back, but good luck getting it. Okay, well, let's also talk about the latest from the ECB. They're prepared to purchase another $1 trillion of euros in QE operations, just tearing a page right out of Dr. Ben Bernanke's playbook, QE to infinity. Now, this is interesting because one would expect that to put a floor under the dollar unless it was buy the rumor, sell the fact. Do you think the markets anticipated this ECB purchase of euros?
Well, I think the market has, and I think it's also discounting that number because first Trichet and then Juncker and then all these guys and then now Draghi, they've all had been more talk than action. And it's kind of the European way. So I think there's a little bit of show me going on in this. You know, the market has discounted that number. We look at what the ECB actually bought this week, and it was paltry. It's like 5 billion euros or something. You know, you don't get to a trillion quickly that way. So it's not – people are waiting to see if they really mean it. And there are big divisions within Europe around this. Germany is not that happy with this whole idea of printing. They've been down this road. They know that sometimes it ends badly. And what's starting to loom, though, is this very critical idea that the Swiss National Bank has really put front and center, which is they've said – the people of their country say, we would like to have our reserves in gold at a certain percentage, and we want it stored here. And that's what we, the people, think would be good for us. And the Swiss National Bank is saying, yeah, but that's not as good for our flexibility in helping our corporate customers out and our government customers out. So they're really showing that what's good for the people and then what's good for the people who are playing the game at the high finance level, those are separate sets of interests. And in Europe, they have a much more populist approach, and people have much more of a say, and they regularly riot when they aren't being taken seriously in these things. So I think there's more of a break on what the ECB can do. The Japanese, gosh, their people will put up with anything if their leaders say to put up with it. It's astonishing what just happened to them. Same in the United States to an extent, but I put Europe at the low end of that. They, you know, until and unless they get into giant economic trouble, the people are going to be resistant to this idea of really going all in on QE.
Another interesting side note here, the ECB recently announced that they could actually add to their gold reserves. And do you have any thoughts on the ECB adding to gold? Because, you know, technically, the euro is backed by a pseudo 15% backing. But, of course, don't ask to receive your gold bullion in exchange for a $500 euro. Any comments there?
Well, I wasn't really sure how to take the spirit of that comment, whether it didn't sound like a plan after I parsed through a couple of articles on it. It looks more like what was asked was, what can the ECB buy with this money it prints out of thin air? And the answer was anything, including gold, right? So it's a possibility. It's one of the things they might consider. But I didn't see an explicit target. But let me contrast that with a Chinese official who said, oh, we have an explicit target. We would like to have 8,900 tons officially in the country. On the official books, where they're still officially standing at just over 1,000 tons, they obviously have a lot more than that, and they're going to have to admit that at some point. But China says that what they're saying with the 8,900 number is they say they want to be on a par with the largest official holders of gold in the world.
You mentioned that their numbers are reliable, but there's some conjecture China might be quietly consuming considerably more, maybe going through channels other than Hong Kong, accumulating massive stockpiles. I guess we can speculate all day long. Any thoughts there?
Well, we can speculate in reverse on that, which is you know, you can imagine smuggling, and smuggling gold, by the way, is actually a large part of the flows that we can't get our hands around, but it happens. I mean, where did the Libyan gold go? Where did the Iraqi gold go? Well, it went somewhere, right? But, you know, when I talk to people who are in the refining business, they say that they're keeping a very sharp eye out for this event. They're waiting to see a piece of gold come in through the refinery, which has the official Chinese mint mark on it, which means that a Chinese mine, which is, you know, 400 tons of gold mined per year, pretty good output, they would then mint that and refine that and mint that, and so they would have a Chinese stamp on it, an official stamp. You know, there's a bounty out. If you see one of these bars out in the refiner world, let us know, because that would show that there's some sneaking out of China going the other direction, and none has been spotted so far, to my knowledge. So if there is any smuggling, it's all one way so far.
We also know that the smuggling business was quite intense into India due to those duty taxes that were levied, and that went on for quite some time. Apparently, though, they've lessened the taxes, at least for the time being. But that kind of leads me to the alternative of gold, and that's silver. Silver did quite well in India during that period because there were no taxes. You have some interesting input here on AG, the cousin of gold, and hyperactive, the ADHD cousin of gold. Tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on silver, please.
If people often ask me, what do I think about gold and silver, like it's one word, and they're two separate words to me with very different outcomes. And so if somebody said, listen, I need one investment, you only get to pick one, I want to buy it, I want to wake up in 20 years, and I want to be almost positive I've done well. Silver is my answer to that for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's structurally an exceptionally short supply given what's going on in the world with mines and mine output and depleting ore grades and all of that other stuff and how much we can get out of the ground compared to the uses we think we want to put that towards, particularly solar, but also emerging uses in the medical industry and other places where we consume silver, meaning we put it into industrial process and you can't really recover it. You know, it's gone. And so we're just using this stuff at a very fast rate, and it runs out at some point. We can see the date where all known stocks of silver basically exhaust. And so the only way we'll get higher reserves of silver back into play is if the price moves up a lot. That's the only solution to this. You know, it has to be worth it for somebody to go after a really mediocre silver play where you're measuring, you know, the ore grade in low grams per ton. So fundamentally, I love it. Today, I still love it because silver right now is below the all-in cost of production for almost all the major producers. And, you know, they'll keep churning it out because they have to keep the mines open and they'll do that. But silver can't stay down here for long before it really begins to impact supply. To me, that's always a good sign. I'm always a big buyer of critical commodities when you're below the cost of production because it's just one of two things has to happen. We have to give up using the stuff or we have to spend more to get it out of the ground.
No, it's very well said. I mean, I've been saying now for a couple of weeks, you may have seen Bloomberg's report. They do quite a good job on keeping a handle on the cost of production, particularly for the yellow metal. And they noted recently that in their list, I think they watch about 15 major producers. Several now are operating below their cost of production, an ominous sign for the bears. I would certainly not want to be bearish in such a scenario. I mean, who knows what they can do in the short term. You talked about photovoltaics. Roughly 1 ounce into a 100-watt solar panel. Good luck trying to reclaim the silver from those panels. It'd be unfeasible from an economic perspective. But in, you know, at $100 or $200 an ounce, suddenly that becomes a more viable opportunity. So as you're saying, it's used in, you know, minuscule amounts. It's used ubiquitously around the technological world in items that we think nothing of tossing into the trash every day. Good luck ever seeing that silver again. Now let's throw into the mix geological aspects that silver tends to pool near the surface, whereas gold runs in deep veins and fissures, and therefore most of the easy pickings, as they say here in the southern United States, are gone. So the opportunity in silver, might just be the more interesting of the two.
Absolutely. From the industrial standpoint, I'm such a huge fan. You know, silver is, the question is, can it be substituted? And sometimes you can substitute things, but silver, here's where you can't substitute it. If you need the most conductive element on the entire periodic table, that's silver. Anything else is less conductive, and it's not a great substitute. It's an inferior substitute. It's the most reflective substance on the table. That, again, no substitute for that. It has strange antimicrobial properties we're just still discovering and making good with. There'll still be health applications around that. But it's the solar that really gets me because, you know, we're looking at, in December, there's the next big climate change conference that's happening down in Lima, Peru this year, and people are going to get there. And again, they're going to say, you know, by 2030, it'd be great if we had a quarter of our electricity coming from alternatives, by which they mean wind and solar. And when they say solar, they mean photovoltaic panels. And when they say that, they're still talking about the ones you have and that I have, which are slabs of polysilicon with solder, silver solder, holding the elements together. And if you just take them at face value, these world leaders, and you say, oh, what would it cost us if we had to, say, take half of that new alternative energy and call that solar panels? How much silver is that? And the answer is, it's more than exists to pull it out of other uses. You know, grandma's silver is going to have to get melted down. And that's if we just go after some modest goals with that. I think there's a strong chance that we go after more aggressive goals with this. I think people are going to, you know, in my own state of Massachusetts, electricity prices just shot up 37% in their latest rate hike. And that was because we really got killed with the vortex last year, and people are really reevaluating that right now. And all of a sudden, solar becomes much more attractive with that 37% rate increase. I predict that's going to continue, those rate increases. And so solar becomes just economically attractive, and some people like it because ecologically it's attractive, and other people like it because then they're not subject to the whims of the grid, whether that's going to be on or not. Whatever the reason is, I'm a big believer in that story. And the only risk to that is, do we find some brand new way of making solar panels? So I watch that very carefully. And people do come up with some interesting stuff, but none of it scales really well at this point, and some of it uses stuff that's even more rare than silver by far.
I would only add that there are significant tax breaks that I hope people are taking advantage of. I've mentioned it over the years here for just the purchase of the solar panels. If they're installed by a professional, 40 or 50% tax breaks on the front end, and then you can receive energy-related tax breaks that can last 30 years or longer. Now, admittedly, you're going to lose a fraction of your efficiency and output each year, but over the long haul, that's minuscule. Over several decades. It's a wise investment, I think, for folks who plan to stay put. Fill in the blanks. Tell me what else you're watching in these markets and in the economy, please.
You know, the markets I'm watching, there's a very strong global slowdown that's happening. We're seeing Europe at stall speed across the whole of the Eurozone, but that's a mixture of very anemic growth in some spots and outright recession in others. Japan, obviously, in full-blown recession. Abenomics, dismal failure on that, and I predict that'll continue. And United States, not that strongly growing at this point, you know, depending on the numbers, if you believe them, China slowing. So we're seeing that in the oil data. We're seeing that in the coal data. You know, Glencore just came out and said they're suspending all mining operations of coal for 3 weeks in all of Australia, which is the largest coal exporter. And that's just because the world is awash in coal right now. And that's because we're seeing a global slowdown in demand for coal. When you see a slowdown in demand for energy, remember what happened in July of 2008. Oil hit $147 a barrel. It started to collapse, and it collapsed very, very suddenly and very rapidly. 3 months later, the stock market sort of recognized what was happening. In October of 2008, rest is history. So I'm watching the oil prices here. Some are saying, well, maybe the oil's down because, you know, the West is punishing Putin for being recalcitrant on Ukraine. Maybe, but if it's telling us a real story and the coal is telling us a real story together, that says global slowdown. I watch stocks continue to make new highs. This is just, we're in bubble territory. It's fantastic to be here again. Third time in 15 years. Nobody's ever had to live through three bubbles in 15 years, but the Fed has managed to pull it off, so golf clap for them. Well done. Now, I've actually been thinking that the WTIC blend was needed to fall a lot in price, primarily because the United States does not export. A chump change of, you know, a couple of ships have left our shores with some natural gas liquids in it, but it's not the same. What's happening is the light sweet that's coming out of the Bakken is of a type that we don't particularly have a lot of refining capacity for. We have a lot of refining capacity for heavier, sour grades, and that's the nature of the beast. So we actually have an oversupply of certain grades here that, honestly, I thought should have been priced much lower for quite a while, and it would really help if we could export those grades. We can't use them here.
Yeah, that's true. And we've always had limited refining capacity here in the U.S.
Yeah, we do. And it's going down. It's been going down for a number of decades. The whole not in my backyard really applies when it comes to a refinery. And by the way, I understand that. So, you know, we haven't built a lot of them. And the ones we did build were with oil companies looking forward into the supply. You know, you don't build a refinery unless you know what's going to be putting into that for the next 40 years. So they looked at the supply that was out there, and nobody saw this emergence of new light sweet grades. Those were all on the wane. So they built refineries for these heavier, sour grades to come up out of Venezuela, out of Saudi Arabia, stuff like that. Again, you know, we're seeing, you know, the price of oil has dropped a lot, and China is buying a huge amount and stuffing it into its strategic reserves. So again, we find China on the other end of the deal saying, that's great, we love lower prices. And so I'm watching all of that. And again, you know, we have the other piece to this macro puzzle, which is very intriguing to me, which is that the United States stopped QE at the end of October. If you look at, you know, if you've seen the chart that shows the correlation between the growth in the Fed balance sheet and the S&P, and those two charts line up, you look carefully, somebody's always going to tell you that they had to lag one of those charts by 3 months. So if you set them off by 3 months, they line up very, very well, which says that where would we expect to see the first stock market recognition of this stop in growth in the Fed balance sheet? And the answer is somewhere in January or February, depending on how you count, if it's normal, right? So I'm not really looking for any weakness in the overall equity market until the beginning of the year. But if all these pieces come together, it could be a real doozy.
Well, we'll certainly have to keep an eye on the energy sector if it is as well correlated, as you say, with the 2007-2008 credit crisis. I mean, what an interesting leading indicator for all of us to watch carefully. I kind of assumed that was a dollar play there, a reaction to the unbelievable advance in the U.S. greenback. I'd like to have you throw in a few comments, if you would, about functional medicine. We covered a lot of interesting bases last time, if you have the time. And I'd certainly like for our listeners to benefit from your outlook, because we seem to be on very close to the same page with regard to the importance of keeping low glucose levels, boosting natural foods, whole foods, avoiding sugar, refined foods, as well as the meats and things, and more of a vegetarian lifestyle is certainly beneficial. I found another article yesterday. One of the serious problems with wheat is that the industrial producers, to boost output, they blast wheat and grains just at the last few minutes with Roundup. They literally douse it in Roundup in order to eke out a little more yield from their harvest. And apparently what happens is it so cooks the poor plants that they just give up a few more. Tell us your thoughts, if you would, maybe a basic overview of functional medicine, please.
Absolutely. I'd love to. You know, at peak prosperity, there's three big areas we think people should focus on. There's physical, financial, and emotional. On that physical side, yeah, we tell people, do some things with your house and garden and stuff like that, but really a big cornerstone of that is your health. And so my own journey through health is a very classic story. I found myself increasingly becoming fairly worn down, and my joints hurt a lot, particularly my tendons, and I started developing a story in my head that said, oh, I'm just getting older. And that's true. But what was really happening after I went and visited a functional medicine specialist and got the tests, I got the appropriate tests. I got, I don't know how many vials of blood were drawn because we ran every possible panel, something you probably should get done, every so often anyway. So this is your liver tests and your blood sugar levels and, these enzymes and all that stuff. A hair test to test for metals, a food sensitivity test to run an antibody panel to see which foods I'm already pre-exposed to, and all of this came back, and the diagnosis was I have leaky gut. It's a condition which means that my gut is so inflamed that it's not doing its proper filtering job. It's got little holes in it, and whole parts of food are entering into my bloodstream, whole things that my body's reacting to and saying, oh, invader, let me attack that. And those antibodies circulate around, and they attack that. But guess what? They attack your joints as well, and your general health, and your overall well-being, and your sense of energy, all of that stuff. So the first step in my program was to start fixing that leaky gut, combination of various supplements or certain things that can support that, but mostly it's cutting out the foods that were inflaming me. And I wouldn't have known these unless I had run my specific panel. Some people say things like, oh, just avoid gluten or just this. But for me, it was more specific. Like within the nuts, almonds are very bad for me. Pecans are not. Okay, so that's my particular readout. Eggs. Off the charts for me. Gluten as well, but not all grains. And so I got this very sort of precise fingerprint of foods that I just said, oh, okay, so cut out a whole bunch and change my eating patterns to include a bunch of others. In that process, took about 2 months before I started to notice a difference, and I'm about 5 months in. The joint pain is gone, and my energy's back up, and I'm once again at the point where my muscles are a lot weaker than my tendons, which was it was the opposite of that for a long time. So it's good to be back. So I have great respect for this idea that you really are what you eat, that a lot of what we eat in this country, which was a lot of my diet before, is just inflammatory. It just fundamentally makes my body start to attack itself, and that's a bad place to be.
Well, Dr. Martinson, as I'm sure you're well aware, and our listeners are also very wise on many topics, inflammation is essentially at the root of virtually all disease, and particularly chronic disease. And it's an epidemic of chronic disease, and I believe it's precisely as you've outlined. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Mark Hyman and his amazing work in the area, and he stands on the shoulders of many giants, like Linus Pauling and Max Gershon. And sure, just a few anecdotes of my own situation. I came to your conclusions completely independently. I didn't have access to the things that Dr. Hyman suggests and you went through. None of those tests were available at my doctor's office. So I essentially started testing all the foods you just spoke about. In fact, a little over 3,000 independent tests over a 2.5 year period. I had to develop my own test because it was just too expensive. I worked with a toxicologist here and developed a test, very inexpensive, about 10 cents or 5 to 10 cents per test. And I found huge levels, interestingly, of cyanide in, guess what, the foods that bug you the most. Eggs have one of the highest concentrations of cyanide anywhere that I could find, as well as arsenic. So that sort of sent off the alarm bells because I also raise chickens just as a hobby. And so I started testing their feed. Even the organic feeds showed cyanide levels off the charts and arsenic off the charts. So then I started feeding them nothing but organic foods that were grown at my family farm and other areas like that. And the cyanide levels dropped to 0.0000%. There was no cyanide in the eggs anymore. So, I mean, again, you know, this is just a working hypothesis, but I'm of the belief that the problem is the feed that we're feeding our cattle, that we're feeding our chickens, and that all goes back to the Roundup that I discussed, how they are just pouring chemicals all over the grains that we're feeding our livestock. And another interesting anecdote here, you think you can go to an area that supplier that is supposedly organic, but guess what? Most of them are growing rice, grains, beans, and things of that nature in toxic soils. Soils that have been toxic for over 150 to 200 years because insecticides and fungicides, what they primarily used was arsenic. And that accumulates in the soil. And as you know, pointed out in our last discussion, those plants, because they're lacking in the nutrients, the vital nutrients in the soils, like selenium, just these natural things that magnesium, grasp for whatever they can find in the roots, the cyanides, the arsenics, the antimonies. This is just a lot of information. Maybe I'm throwing out too much there. Any final parting comments?
This is a huge area which, you know, people often, if they're unacquainted, if they're not in the food cycle, if you don't have a garden and you don't have your hands in the dirt and you don't understand the food cycle, you know, all you know is you walk in the grocery store and there's broccoli and you look at it and every year it looks the same. You know, there's a nice head of broccoli. There it is. But what's happening is that these plants are very complex creatures, just like you or I, and they need not just nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, the big things you might dump on that sort of stimulate overall leafy growth, but to be healthy, they need calcium, they need selenium, they need iron. They need all of these trace elements in various levels, and the more you farm, the more those things get sucked up into the plants, put on a truck, shipped out to a store, somebody eats it, and pardon me, but it gets flushed out to sea, right? So we have this one-way conveyor belt where we're stripping the soils of these micronutrients and even the macronutrients, and they aren't getting replaced. And so what happens is that, you know, you see the same head of broccoli, but over time it's becoming less and less and less nutrient dense. It's got less and less of the stuff you need. That's part one. And then part two is what you mentioned. When the soil gets depleted, the plant's looking around, it's like, I need calcium. And it can't find any, and it goes, oh, well, here's some arsenic. I'll take that instead, right? And they're doing that a little bit out of desperation because, you know, lacking the minerals they need, they'll take other things on. Plants are just like us in that regard. You know, the overall quality of the food is going down. You mentioned that whole idea of spiking plants with Roundup so they put their last dying effort into putting an extra percent or two into the kernels of wheat. Those sorts of practices that we're doing are, they might be cost-effective, but, oh, my gosh, they are just horrible for ourselves as individuals. They're horrible for the world outside of us. And I now understand that my body is it's a very leaky thing. It communicates all the time with the world around it. And I no longer believe it's possible to poison our fields and have a healthy body when I eat the stuff that comes off those fields. Those two things we're going to learn this again, probably the hard way. They're linked. And you have to understand how they're linked.
Ultimately, people have to wake up. And unfortunately, this is the type of topic that just until people start to experience their own symptoms, if you're having any inflammation in your body, it tends to begin there. People forget that, you know, our intestines are really a part of our skin. And if that becomes injured in any way, of course you have direct access to our blood supply and your immune system. Our intestines really are the backbone of our immune system. If our digestion is solid, then we're probably going to have a relatively solid immune system. If not, your whole system is going to be wrecked. I hope folks, get a lot from this discussion and start to talk to people, make changes in their families, but also do everything they can to, wake up our legislators that we've got to make a change as a society. It's virtually impossible today not to have some GMO food and things of that nature. And one little takeaway here I'd throw out there, I've been gardening for over 40 years, and I can tell you that everything I tested from the garden never never had any of the toxins we've been discussing today. Nothing. And that's why every day we eat something from our family's garden. Even our animals. We have fish, birds, dogs, everything on as much as we can pull out of the ground. What you get from the store in almost every instance has some level of those metals we talked about, and they accumulate. You might think, well, a little bit here, a little bit there. Wrong. The body, the liver becomes toxic. It's overwhelmed. It's already dealing with all the smoke in the air and toxins in the air and pollutants in the air and the detergents you're using and the fluoride toothpaste you're using, and the list goes on and on. So a lot of great stuff today. Dr. Mertensen, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule for us. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio. And please tell people more about the services you provide.
Well, first, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to be here with you again. And at peakprosperity.com, we have a whole community of people who are really looking at how the world is changing and how they can become more resilient and more engaged in the face of the very big challenges that we see coming. You know, our belief is the next 20 years are just not going to be like the last 20 years. So information is the new money. You have to understand the context of the story we're in, just like we've been discussing the important context around food and nutrition and things like that. There's a lot of context out there, and people are waking up to it. Our government isn't talking about it. Your legislators aren't talking about it. It's not in the newspaper, so it's up to us, and that's what we do. And we help people take action around the face of these challenges we see in healthy, positive ways.
No, it's so well said. And, you know, this information that we're touching on today has a foundation in some truly profound ideas that have really been around for about 100 years. And I just think it's sad that despite the incredible education level that our society has today, it takes so many decades for the need-to-know information to work its way through the system. Because, you know, as they say in functional medicine, it makes a lot of dollars, but unfortunately, you know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense the way our medical system is set up today. And what we need is something that will encourage a healthy lifestyle so that these chronic diseases, the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and all the other degenerative chronic illnesses, most of which are avoidable and reversible in many cases, just such an important topic. So I want to encourage everyone to navigate your browsers over to Dr. Mertensen's wellness websites and stay in touch with them. Very good having you on the show, sir.
It's been a pleasure of mine. Thanks so much.